championship on many things.
And beginning at the very beginning, actually, but then going through the...
Of course, he was with the first delegation, the Adlai Stevenson. So.
He was, yeah. And then he was either the permanent representative in New York, or he was the foreign office during Korea. Very important. Mr. Ambassador, to...
I saw him a few months ago. He was in good shape. And
he'd had a stroke, I understand, but that was several months ago, and apparently he recovered remarkably well. Yeah. One specific question I wanted to ask you. In 1957, Dag Hammarskjöld established a study group, which included an Anatoly Dobrynin, to examine and draw conclusions from the UNEF experience. And I don't know whether, did you have contact with Dobrynin when he was in the secretariat in that sense? You didn't know. And actually, it's...
Who appointed the study group?
Hammarskjöld. And the report has been published. It exists.
I'll find it in the library then.
Yes. It points to the weaknesses as well as the strengths. And Hammarskjöld apparently was... Well, this is not my interview. Anyhow, he wanted to... play down somewhat any euphoria about what peacekeeping operations could do.
Wait a minute, this was before the fiasco of Ruthant, of course.
Yes, before the fiasco of Ruthant.
I wonder why he had reason to look at it then.
Well, Brian Urquhart has talked about it on tape, actually. It's not in his books, but he gives that as the reason why Hammarskjöld established this group. In any event, you personally, if you were doing an assessment of the UNEF experience, how would you come out with it?
The UNEF, while it lasted, was a success story. The fact is it enabled Israel to create a new dimension in international communications.
Yeah.
It sounds fantastic if I say we became a two-ocean country. It's at the root of our success in Africa and Asia, in creating that great network of development agreements.
Yeah.
It had access. It gave us independence in our oil traffic. It made Eilat a center of oil traffic, which I think it still is now, even in spite of what's happened in Iran. It was a very viable. And that's why it's tragic that it was brought to an end. It could have created a new belief in the United Nations as a stabilizing influence in international conflicts. And there was not a single shot fired in anger from Gaza.
Remarkable.
Because although the Egyptian administration came back, the Egyptian army didn't come back.
So you would conclude that this was a very persuasive illustration of what a peacekeeping operation can do, a multilateral operation.
Yes. Except its effects were diminished by the skepticism about its durability.
Yes. Bringing it up to date, how do you assess that in terms of the present world situation? Now, there are increasing demands now, recall, for peacekeeping operations of a different type.
I'd say in general that theoretically, I'm going to have a talk with this with Perez de Cuellar before I finish my book. The present context, unless Glasnost is going to be killed by Lithuania, it's quite a setback, I must say. If Glasnost, Perestroika stays alive, that's a situation which international organization ought to come back into its own.
Yeah.
Seems to be the ideal arena in which the new spirit can be expressed, a planetary concern. The functional organizations ought to have much more freedom now without becoming slangy matters, UNESCO and the NEVEO. The Secretary General ought to become a much more important figure. I don't know how he sees that, but I would say in theory this ought to be we ought to be going back to the era, what I've called the first 5 years, in which the UN was really the central arena for international diplomacy.
There
also, there's a fact, I think the American administration is less unilateralist than it was in Reagan's time.
Yes.
And Bush also has a United Nations background. I haven't seen it developing, but perhaps it's too early because the assembly will then start meeting again for the first time since Perestroika, which will be in September. I don't know if the Secretary General is thinking of how to put a stake for the UN into this new situation.
Well, I can tell you he very much is.
Yes.
And just to if you again would give your thoughts on this particular change, because between the first 5 years yes. and now, the nature of conflict has altered a good
sure.
bit. There are not many wars left that are between states
right.
or between national armies. They tend to stem now from societal roots. And that raises a question. You were mentioning just now the functional organizations, the greater freedom and so forth.
Yeah.
Do you see the United Nations or multilateral organizations in general having the capacity to deal with this type of conflict, which is likely to characterize, actually, the world?
Well, here we come across one of the paradoxes of the foreign aid situation. The preference of the donor powers is that if they give this money away, and especially if they have to persuade their own parliaments, they'd like to give it away under their own flag. And that's why, as I said in my new diplomacy, the tendency is in the United States to want to wrap its own flag around itself where it is active. And therefore the disproportion between what it's prepared to do in its bilateral programs and the relatively small amount that it's prepared to devote in its foreign aid to international agencies, whether that would change or not. What makes me a little pessimistic is, as I've said, that money has come not from governments, but from parliaments. The parliaments tend to be proprietary. They don't want to go to Nigeria. Let's say that the United States has built some great system of irrigation. They want the stars and stripes on it, and they don't want the blue flag. That's the problem. Whether an American administration can be disinterested enough to allow the international agencies to take responsibility, which they should, for one reason, the recipient countries are more congenial to accept aid from an international agency than from a foreign power, because then they're said to be under domination, and Washington runs you, etc. An international agency can't dominate anybody.
Yes.
One reason why the Israeli programs were successful was that the recipient powers knew that they could throw us out at 5 minutes' notice. They weren't sure about that at all from the Soviet Union or China.
Yeah.
And they didn't want this Yankee imperialism, especially in Latin America. So it would be intelligent of the United States, but that really means that the glasnost thing has to take hold and come to expression in the United Nations, which depends on what will happen in the fall. And that's why I'm very perturbed by the idea that in the fall they'll be discussing how to get the Soviets out of Lithuania,
yes.
or how to get the Lithuanians to be less impatient.
Yes.
It's a tragic thing. It's emotional. I saw them yesterday on the Sunday programs. Perhaps the summit won't be held. Or if it will be held, it will be much more like a Khrushchev Eisenhower summit, slanging each other.
If indeed the United Nations were to be able to play a more decisive role in bringing assistance in order to head off the type of conflict that stems from social and economic causes, it would require a greater coordination by the United Nations, I think, of
yes.
the functional agencies. Based on your experience, which of course was not so directly related to ECOSOC, but do you have any feeling that the United Nations is capable of doing that, that there is a possibility?
The ECOSOC thing has been rather weak because each agency has become a kind of a, like the Roman governors, they're independent imperiums, and that much more depends on who are the directors general. I mean, there's this misfortune with the UNESCO that degenerated under this African gentleman. And one of the problems of the UN is this devotion to geographical representation. You might have to have an African president when there isn't one available, but it's got to be there. Then it's got to be Latin America. I don't see any escape from that. But if you take the most powerful of them, which is the World Bank, the Monetary Fund, they're pretty independent organizations. And, I would say even their dependence on the Secretary General is rather weak. He doesn't interfere much. There's never really been a Secretary General who saw the functional agencies as his main terrain. They're all captivated by the conflictual diplomatic conditions.
Well, in a sense, it's an area where he has no power.
Yes. In other words, their link is weaker, of course, than the international corporate sphere. It's a very loose federation of agencies. And that's, I think, who is the Director General of the UNESCO, and the FAO counts much more than anything in the center.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Ambassador, to go ahead to a rather broad question. In your positions from the beginning, you were able to work with and observe actually four American presidents very closely, all of whom were directly involved in the Middle Eastern situation and in the United Nations role in the Middle Eastern situation. And I wondered if you could give your perception of the, not of the presidents as individuals, but of their attitudes toward working with the United Nations, through the United Nations, in terms of the Middle Eastern situation.
In general, it's followed the curve that it was highest in the early days, and then it declined. Truman's attitude to the UN was very respectful. Eisenhower's was almost deferential. I used to say that in Eisenhower's theology, between the President of the United States and God, there was an intermediate level of the Secretary General of the United Nations. I remember Foster Dulles' speech about Suez. He said more or less that our devotion to the UN transcends our devotion to our allies and our strategic interests. I think it's the only occasion where you can prove that a major power gave the United Nations predominance over its own egotistical interests. Although we didn't like it at the time, there was a degree of acceptance of self-sacrifice because, frankly, strategically, they ought to have given more support to the British and the French. And people like Acheson said, so what the hell are you doing? Kissinger says it to this day. If he had been around, he would have supported the British and French, or at least prevented from being humiliated, because the humiliation of Britain and France injured American interests and created the bipolar world. Suez created the bipolar world instead of the diverse world. Then you come on later in the scene, Johnson became very disillusioned by his experience in 67.
Yeah.
And he said to me, you've got to go through the motions of going to the UN. I would be extraordinarily surprised if they were to do anything. And his reference was to U Thant, who was a pain in the neck for him.
I was going
to
say, yes.
And
also on Vietnam.
And Goldberg also began to regret that he hadn't stayed in the Supreme Court. Because the idea that in that job he was going to have a preponderant role in American foreign policy. He found that, as Stevenson found out, that isn't true. It's not true, first of all, because of physical absence. If you're not in Washington, the fact that you're a member of the cabinet and of the Security Council, that doesn't count very much. And I see now the United States has expressed that. It's appointment of a career officer. No longer these political sort of pundits like Cabot Lodge and Stevenson and Moynihan and Kirkpatrick. Johnson became really irritated by the attitude on 67. Nixon didn't. I think he developed also the idea that great power politics is a concert, like concert of Europe, except that the direct American-Soviet line, that's the important thing. No disposition to say let the UN take it, anything over. Carter should have had that disposition, but in the end he found that when there was a massive and important conflict to be resolved, it had to be resolved outside the UN system. Largely because the UN had spoilt its credentials with Israel. That's why Camp David had to be done as a separate American mediation. And the Geneva Conference was an opportunity, but Kissinger was so apathetic about international organizations that he stole the UN flag, hijacked it, went off on his own, and it came back only for the signature.
If I recall correctly, that's the only time the Secretary General was present, was at the opening at the end.
That was arranged at the beginning, incidentally. That was in the letter. That's because Israel was worried. And Kissinger couldn't get us to go there until he gave us a letter saying the Secretary General only simply set the ball rolling, but then the ball then abandons the scene. Actually, in Kissinger's time also, he got Waldheim to accept that role in the Indochina Conference as well in Paris. So he became a kind of a monarch breaking the bottle to launch a ship. But after that, the ship goes over to somebody else.
Why did Israel have the reservations about...
Because with the UN, we had this built-in majority against us, and therefore the less answerable to the UN, the better for us. There was even some problem. I thought it was a great success, and I got Golder to agree to an American-Soviet chairmanship of the conference. And later on, Peres tried to revive it by accepting the idea of the five permanent members inaugurating the conference. And but even then, the United States was very dubious about it because you mean the Soviet Union is going to come in again? I don't know what they would say now. We said, Peres said yes, because if you had that arrangement, Israel would be the predominant military power, the United States would be the predominant political power, nothing could happen that America and Israel didn't want to happen.
There was the brief period at the beginning of the Carter administration when there was the successful consultation between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Yeah, exactly, yes, in October.
Exactly.
But even that was, I couldn't call that a United Nations framework. Carter believed, and he believes now even more strongly, that I believe we'll have to come back to that. And that it's much more logical now that the Soviet Union has a much less acrimonious relationship with Israel.
This gets away from the United Nations a minute, but just to divert, there is the theory that this move by Carter to reach an understanding with the Soviets was one of the things that prompted Sadat with his move toward Israel. Do you agree with that?
Yes, because he was much more fanatical about the Soviet Union than we were. And he said if they could bring the Soviet Union, he had broken relations, that is his enemy. And he said, if that's going to be, let me go to Israel instead. I don't need the Soviet Union in the picture. And in fact, he dictated that there should be a unilateral American mediation. Because he accepted Carter very well as America, as the United States, but not for the Soviet Union tagging on behind. In the disengagement agreements, with Egypt in 1974, both Kissinger and I would have accepted the idea of signing that in Geneva. Or rather, of conducting the discussions in Geneva. I think in the end we did sign in Geneva.
It was signed in Geneva, but you mean the disengagement on the military front,
Kilometer One.
Yes. Where there was a United Nations presence, actually.
Yes, but very, very muted. With Syria, they insisted on the United Nations, and there was a military signature in Geneva. The fact is that by actions, chiefly, I must say, General Assembly actions, the Security Council has always been more central. In fact, I would say the Arabs would say it's gone the other way, because the United States would veto anything to which any Israeli say. As if Mr. Sharon were to say that he had to capture Damascus. The United States would veto a resolution of criticism. I'm not sure it's very good for us, but that's what it happens, because they are passionately against these settlements nationally, push personally. They won't allow the Security Council to criticize them. And the reason they give is not that they're against these resolutions, which the other 14 accept. They're for it, but they don't want to give the Security Council the idea that it's back in business. Because if you, and here I see they have a point, if you allow the Council to make one condemnation, then it'll meet every 3 weeks to condemn something in Israel.
You think that's a stronger influence than the consideration of the American Jewish community?
I think that's part of it. When they have their things passed, nothing terrible has happened. They did abstain on something to do with the settlements. But in general, of course, they say quite correctly, here it's the Arabs' fault. They formulate their texts in such a way that there's no balance. And they're rather stupid in not allowing some third party to formulate the texts in a way that isn't pro-Arab. For instance, to allow the Europeans. It's always a resolution which is full of anti-Israeli rhetoric. And then the American representative says, we agree that Israel shouldn't have done this, etc., etc., and then they make an anti-Israeli speech. You say, we can't vote for the text because it's not balanced. It only condemns violence if it emanates from Israel. It doesn't condemn violence which either before or after emanates from there. But the PLO is becoming a little more sophisticated. Once they start getting Sweden or somebody else, or even Britain for that matter, to formulate a resolution, then they might get it through.
Another 242.
Yeah.
Mr. Ambassador, going now from presidents to secretaries general, you have recorded your impressions pretty well in your book of the first secretaries general. You didn't get around to Mr. Waldheim, I don't believe. I wonder if you many...
Well, one's a personal reason. I never served with him, really. Because I'm... It was a period during which my work was in the parliamentary thing and not so much in the executive branch. Also, I once said of him, I'm afraid he got to hear it, that his career refutes the theory that nature abhors a vacuum. On the other hand, my friends who worked with him say that Israel had no cause for complaint. I mean, my friend Herzog, I think he was most of the time with him, said that he was very helpful on Soviet Jewry. He came to Israel, he had a little mishap. I gave him a lunch or dinner, and he said, how nice it is to be here in this capital of Israel. And the Israeli television celebrated this too early, so we more or less revoked it by calling it the spiritual capital of Christianity, of the world. But whatever has arisen around him since then had no expression whatever during his secretary generalship. And I know he's rather grateful because President Herzog has been against this witch hunt, as he calls it. Against it.
Yes, and from my own experience.
Also, my own feeling is that all one could say is that he was a Wehrmacht officer.
Yes.
And therefore he didn't have any missions that we would regard as particularly sympathetic. I mean, whatever he had to do would be either whatever the Germans do, they're either killing Jews or killing Englishmen or killing Americans, but they didn't have any missions with which we would have no objection.
And it was my experience that he actually did try his best to fend off the Zionism resolution.
Yes.
He was unsuccessful.
That's interesting. What is the evidence for that? Did he make speeches or did he
no,
just
no.
talk to people?
Entirely private. I think there's nothing on the record.
Yeah.
Mr. Ambassador, a final question in this regard. Having observed these secretaries general, each had somewhat different qualifications, what is your assessment of the requirements that a future secretary general should have?
Well, the qualification used to be that you must not have annoyed anybody. I remember after Hammarskjöld, Black and Jeb came to see me and said, did I know anything about Luthan's attitude? And I came back and I said, my experience is this.